current state. Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR. You may have heard us mention that May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And coming up in our program a little bit later on, one Lansing woman's compelling story of her battle with mental illness. That and more here for a Thursday edition of Current State. Back in February, when he announced his impending retirement from the U.S. Congress, our next guest described himself as the luckiest man in shoe leather. Michigan Congressman John Dingell then explained why.
I was given the greatest of all honors. I was born a citizen of the greatest, freest, and grandest nation in the history of mankind, the United States of America. And I've been honored to call this country home for 86 years.
Mr. Dingell holds the record as America's longest-serving elected federal official, continuously representing Michigan's 12th District since 1955. That's 21,000 days, during which he cast 25,000 votes, serving alongside 11 U.S. presidents. He's played a role in some of Congress's most memorable legislation, the 1964 Voting Rights Act, Medicare, and the Affordable Care Act. His career there will end this year, although the Dingell name may carry on since his wife Debbie is a candidate for the office. Yesterday afternoon, Congressman Dingell arrived on Mackinac Island for the Detroit Regional Chamber's annual policy conference. I had the chance to speak with him and first ask what he thinks of the new Michigan law increasing the minimum wage starting in September.
I think that it was necessary that we have additional work done on minimum wage law in the state of Michigan and in the country. As you will note, the federal government proposes to go to $10.10. Michigan has not gone that far, and very frankly, I think it's kind of a sin and a shame that we do not see to it that our people have the kind of wage that will enable them to work decently and to have a decent income by working one job. We have all kinds of people in this country who are not able to provide a decent living for their people because they're not paid sufficiently. And I'm hopeful that this will help, although I think we probably are going to have to go higher.
I want to ask you about the ruling allowing your fellow Michigan Congressman John Conyers to continue his candidacy despite his campaign using unregistered voters to circulate petitions. Some number of people say it's a pointless rule, but that it's a rule nonetheless and that it should apply to Mr. Conyers as well. What do you think?
Well, it is a statute of the state of Michigan, which defines two things. One, the qualifications for people to put names on petitions so that a person can become a candidate for public office. And the other thing is to see to it that the qualifications of the persons who circulate these petitions are sufficient to comply with state law. I've got to say that I'm pleased that John is on the calendar, but I've also got to observe that it is quite important, I think, that the state of Michigan have the ability to fix the qualifications of persons who are going to deal with who will be the electors and so forth in the state of Michigan.
Your wife, Debbie, is a candidate to replace you in Congress. How do you feel about that? Are you confident she'll prevail and get elected?
Well, first of all, one, she's one of the smartest, nicest, most decent women I know. She's probably one of the smartest politicians I've ever met. And she's a woman who cares about Michigan, Michigan's jobs. She has no end of experience to qualify her for that elective office. And frankly, I'm looking forward to voting for her and to addressing her as Congressman Dingell.
How active of a consulting role do you think you'll play if she's elected?
I remember when she is elected, she is going to be the candidate, and she is going to be the person who is elected. I will be there to help her as she feels she needs the help, but I'm not going to continue being the congressman. She's going to be the congressman, and she's going to provide the service that she is elected to provide the people of Michigan.
Some polls and prognosticators are expecting the Republicans to retake the U.S. Senate this fall. Are you preparing for that?
My old dad used to have an old Polish saying that he used to say that worked pretty well, and I always remember it. And that is, before you sell the bear's hide, you first got to shoot the bear. And I have to tell you, I don't think that who is going to shoot that bear or sell that bear's hide yet is very clear. I think the Democrats have an excellent chance. The Republicans have spent an awful lot of time putting their foot in their mouth. As a matter of fact, as my old daddy used to say, they spend an awful lot of time, quite honestly, putting their foot in their mouth, and in fact, they spend more time, quite frankly, putting their foot in their mouth than they do taking out.
For decades, you wanted national health insurance in this country. In fact, you submitted a proposal for it every year from 1957 for decades. Do you feel the Affordable Care Act is subject to change, and does that concern you?
Well, the only perfect law I can recall is the Ten Commandments. And very frankly, they were written by the finger of God on a tablet of stone for Moses. It also, I have to tell you, is something which I think shows how hard it is to get legislation through. If I were to bring the Ten Commandments up in this particular Congress, I'd have serious doubts that I could get it through. I think the Affordable Care Act is going to work very well. We have now covered 8 million Americans who have no coverage. We now have seen to it that kids can stay on their parents' care program until they're 26. We also have seen to it that no longer can they kick you out of the hospital because you get sick. No longer can they deny you health care because you have a pre-existing condition. And there are all kinds of things that are in there for the benefit of patients, which is, after all, the reason for health insurance, and that is to take care of the patient as opposed to making money for the insurance company.
Michigan Congressman John Dingell is our special guest here on WKAR's Current State. We're speaking with Congressman Dingell from up at Mackinac Island at the Detroit Regional Chamber Policy Conference. Much has been made of the growing inability of congressional Democrats and Republicans to work together in recent years. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's a great shame. I've always felt that compromise is an honorable word, and that our founding fathers intended that we should work together for the broad overall good of the country. And that was one of the things that I always did when I ran the Commerce Committee for better than 16 years. And we reported out legislation by votes which passed the House floor by 420-10 or something like that, because I believed that all members had the right to be heard and all members had a duty not only to be heard, but a duty to see to it that they had the opportunity to bring the thoughts and concerns of their people before the Congress, because that's the way the best legislation happens to be written.
Do you think, Congressman, Americans should expect this kind of tension between the parties indefinitely, or is this a phase that will pass?
Oh, brother, I hope it's a phase that passes. This is not serving the interests of the country at all. It's very much out of the interests of the public. It is bad for the country. It is bad for the nation. And it is certainly hurting. The country. It's something that we don't need over here. And very frankly, this is our country, and we've got to pull together. And one of the things that we've got to do is to stop this business of sitting in the boat with all of our fellow Americans and saying, pardon me, but your end of the boat is sinking.
Out of the 25,000 votes that you have cast in your career, you called your vote for the 1964 Voting Rights Act the most important. What makes that your most important vote?
Well, if you will remember looking at television and listening to the radio and reading the papers, I think you'll be horrified when you see what all transpired in this country. You'll see that there was rioting, that African Americans had dogs sicked on them. They were beaten with clubs. They were sprinkled with fire hoses. They were locked up overnight. They were murdered, and frankly, they showed an extraordinary level of decency in the way they sought their legitimate rights. And the real question is, how much longer would African Americans have tolerated that situation? That was something which had to be addressed, something which would be addressed, so that we saw to it that every American has all of the rights which he's supposed to have. Remember, the most important single right American has is probably the right to vote. That's the right he has to, or she has, to see to it that they actually have a say about what goes on in their country.
You were a House page on the House floor on December 8th, 1941, with your father, Congressman John Dingell, when you both heard President Roosevelt declare war on Japan. How well do you remember that?
That was a very, very, that was something you do not forget. It was by no means certain that we were going to win that war. The Japanese had just sunk the entire Pacific fleet of the United States. The United States was seeing all of its allies in the Pacific getting the daylights beaten out of them by the Japanese. The United States was confronting massive, massive problems in Europe. It was a terrible, terrible, terrible time. And so I'd have to say, even though I was not in the Congress while Roosevelt was there, I watched it very closely, not only through my own eyes, but also through Dad's. And I have to say, of all the presidents, the greatest that I've had any real acquaintance with was, frankly, President Roosevelt.
And how do you intend to spend your time once you're out of Congress? What kind of post-congressional life do you expect to be leading?
Well, I intend to be living with a beautiful woman, an extraordinary woman in terms of her ability, and I intend to enjoy both of those. I have kids and grandbabies, and I'm of whom I am very proud, and I have a lot of things I would like to do. I'm going to be a spouse, and I'm not going to get in the hair of my wife. I've told her that if she's elected, and I'm pretty well convinced that she will be, that I want to see her be a first-class Deborah and not a second-rate John.
Michigan Democratic Congressman John Dingell from Mackinac Island reflecting on issues, history, and his wife Deborah's bid to replace him in the U.S. Congress. This year, Representative Dingell is concluding the longest career in the history of the Congress. It began in 1955. We want to thank both the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta and WDET Radio in Detroit for assistance on Mackinac Island with this interview. If you found yourself passing through Lansing City Hall these past couple of days, you may have noticed a treasured piece of the city's past. In the lobby at City Hall now sits a 19-1 curved dash Olds Roundabout. It'll be on display there through October as part of a new exhibit entitled Made in Lansing. The collection celebrates 125 years of manufacturing innovation that's taken place in Michigan's capital city. It features many items that may not readily come to mind, even for longtime Lansing natives. Joining us today are the leaders of the two organizations co-sponsoring Made in Lansing. We welcome back Valerie Marvin, president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing. Valerie, good to see you.
Good morning.
And Bill Adcock is executive director of the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum. Bill, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mark.
Made in Lansing focuses on items from Lansing's manufacturing history dating back to the 19th century. Valerie, first tell us where these items are. Give us an idea of where these items came from. Are these already on display in various places, or did you lift things from private collections, or what?
Some of them came from barns and basements.
Oh, my.
Some of the items are from the Historical Society's collection. Others are on loan from other institutions, such as the R.E. Olds Museum. And then we also reached out to several private collectors in the area, some of whom have spent the last 40 years building wonderful collections of Lansing products.
How interesting to have the private items as well. And arguably, Bill, the centerpiece of this is the 19-1 curved dash Oldsmobile. If Lansing's manufacturing history has a centerpiece, I would imagine that's it. For our listeners who are less aware of this vehicle, describe it for them.
Well, it's not a curved dash runabout. It's a curved dash Olds. It's not a roundabout. It's a runabout.
Okay.
No, R.E. built his first car in 1897. He built four of those, and that led to the forming of the Olds Motor Works, which was incorporated in Detroit in 1901. It actually was incorporated in 1899. Their first car was built in 1901. And as a matter of fact, we almost didn't have that car here. Because the factory was located in Detroit, it burned down. And it was only because it burned down is the Lansing Businessmen's Association said, bring your car company back here. We'll give you 53 acres and build your new car company, rebuild it here in Lansing. Had it not been for that fire, we probably wouldn't have a car business here. And we ended up with three manufacturers here, the Rio Motor Car Company and Durant.
So the vehicle that's on display in City Hall was actually assembled in Detroit?
That one... We don't know if it was assembled in Detroit or assembled in Lansing.
In Lansing.
It could have been either. They were building that same car, exact car, in both factories. And they built in both factories for 5 years, and then all production moved to Lansing in 2005.
Now, I know the city has a rich and enduring manufacturing history, Valerie, but, you know, once I get beyond the 01 curved dash and all of the other cars that GM has created in the meantime, I start getting a little thinner than I'd like to admit. What are some other items or two on display that kind of capture maybe lesser known parts of the city's manufacturing history?
Well, before we were ever making cars, we were making a lot of agricultural implements here, and we were making a lot of stoves. The Beaumont Stove Company actually was Lansing's largest employer before the auto industry came about. And we have a Beaumont stove that is on display. These were sold across America. They could be used for both cooking and also parlor stoves that you would put in the different rooms of your house. And I know some local families who actually still use them today in their homes. As the 20th century evolved, we started producing a lot of different things. One of my favorite stories is the pocket protector, which we sort of joke about today is
the icon of intellectuals everywhere. Yes.
Intellectuals. That's a polite way of saying it.
Nerds.
Nerds. There we go. Sure. Hurley Smith was an engineer who was born in Michigan and was living in Buffalo, New York in the 1940s. And the company he was working for at the time got in a little bit of legal trouble, and he actually was willing to testify against the company. So he promptly found himself unemployed and decided that he was going to do some work on a project that he had been tinkering with. His wife, like many wives, was always complaining that he was staining his shirts with ink from the pens he carried in his pocket. So he decided to create what he called a pocket shield. And he was literally melting the plastic using his wife's iron, which I can only imagine how happy she was about that. But he created what is today the pocket protector, Everclear. And he started producing them just in his home in Buffalo, but actually decided Lansing was the place to manufacture these. So they picked up, they moved to Lansing. He opened a small production facility on Cedar Street. And for the next 10 years, about a dozen people in Lansing made pocket protectors.
Oh, but and what? I'm sorry, what were the years again there?
He moved to Lansing in 49. He filed the patent in 47.
Okay.
But 49 to about 59 is when those were being produced. And it's a reminder that not only large items were made here, but also these little tiny things that, for better or for worse, became cultural icons in their own way.
Bill Adcock, what else came to this display from the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum?
Most of this displays that we have, we just gave the curve dash, but we have other implements like she was talking about at our museum. There's a lot of UAW artifact there. And if your listeners, we have Tourist in Your Own Town this weekend.
Right.
This is open to the public. This is great for family, great for kids. Whether it's MSU, whether it's East Lansing, Old Town, Rio Town, Downtown Lansing, they all ought to get on this. It's free. You spend a buck to get a passport, and every venue is free after that.
And it does run through October if you miss that opportunity here. This weekend, but this Saturday is a unique opportunity to take a lot of these attractions in. Our guests here on Current State, Valerie Marvin, president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing, and Bill Adcock, executive director of the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum in Lansing. Made in Lansing features Lansing's manufacturing history, and it's on display now in the in Lansing City Hall. Valerie, is there a chance to get to know the people behind some of these inventions? Because that can be as interesting as the inventions themselves.
Yes. The exhibit opens officially this weekend. We have an opening at City Hall from 5 to 7 on Friday night, and then it will be open all day Saturday, as will the portion of the exhibit at the R.E. Olds Museum. But throughout the summer and into the fall, we're going to be doing a lot of programming. There'll be information on our website about that, lansinghistory.org. And for example, Hurley Smith's grandson, who still lives in Lansing and is local, is going to come and do a talk about his grandfather
terrific.
Go more in depth into the story there.
Does the exhibit include the World War II era? I guess the pocket protector is just after the World War II era. But
we actually have some wooden wheels from Pruden from World War I that are believed to be from an artillery piece. The R.E. Olds Museum has some great World War II exhibits that we will be spotlighting as well.
Tell us about those, Bill.
Well, obviously, when World War II came about, all the production of cars and trucks ceased. These companies went to wartime production, and we built a lot of shells in Rio and also Oldsmobile. They built a lot of artillery shells. They built torpedo bombs. Rio still a few trucks, but everything went to military production. We have quite a display of the military production that came out of Lansing.
Are there plans, Valerie, to display this exhibit elsewhere, or maybe a more permanent display or a traveling display?
We would be very interested in moving part of it once it closes at City Hall. We call these pop-up exhibits because we like them to appear at different places around town. So if there's another facility out there who would be interested in hosting it come next winter, we would certainly be interested.
Okay. Bill, update us on what else is going on at the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum. How many vehicles do you have all together at the Olds Museum?
Yeah, we have probably 67 vehicles and show about 58 of those at the museum. Cars, trucks, there's obviously Oldsmobiles, Rios, Durants, there's a Viking there. We have the very first, the only one that they made for 1897, motor wagons, they were called. We have the only one in existence still there. It belongs to the Smithsonian, but it's on loan. We've had it for 15, 16 years now. It'll always probably be there. We also have the one and only 1899 electric that RE built. He built four of those. One left. We have that.
So the electric car goes back a little bit further than most people know.
And we also have an EV1. That was GM's.
Of course.
In the 90s.
In the 90s. Very mm-hmm. good. Well, Bill Adcox, Executive Director of the R.E. Olds Transportation Museum in Lansing. We've also been joined by Valerie Marvin. Hard at work, both of them. Valerie's president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing. Be sure to check out Made in Lansing this Saturday, if at all possible, during Be a Tourist in Your Own Town, but it remains at City Hall through October. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and our producer Joe Lindstroth is here with the remarkable story of one Lansing woman's struggle with mental illness. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark. You know, that well-trodden narrative that links violence and mental illness is back in the media with last week's horrible shootings in Santa Barbara. But, you know, for every Elliot Rodger or Adam Lanza at Sandy Hook or James Holmes in Aurora, Colorado, there are many others who are more like longtime Lansing resident Jerry Nicole Wright. People who are just trying their best to cope with their illness and live as a normal life as possible. You know, in fact, statistics show that people who suffer from a severe mental illness are more likely to be the victim of a crime than the perpetrator. Jerry Nicole suffers from borderline personality disorder, which is a mental illness characterized by wide mood swings, impulsive behavior, and unstable relationships. She's had it most of her life, and she's worked extremely hard to keep the illness from taking over her life. She has a job. She's been sober for 24 years. She's been a member of Charterhouse, a club for mentally ill adults in Lansing, for 11 years. And she's been married for 2 decades. But as you'll hear, getting to this point in her life hasn't been easy.
As a borderline, I had a thinking disorder or a thinking illness. I would feel a feeling and immediately act on it. I've had a lot of symptoms, a lot of struggles. I used to do self-destructive behavior.
When you were younger, before you were told what you had, how did this impact your relationships with other people, with your job, with school?
When I was younger, I'm thinking back to high school, I would be come in very depressed, very sad. But by the end of the day, it was like I was, you know, on cloud nine with my friends, my peers at high school. But even back then, I was off. You know, that's when the drinking started. That's when things were kind of out of control. My mood was just wasn't regulated.
And you mentioned the drinking. Was that part of how you coped with these feelings early on in your life?
That was how I coped, yes. I didn't know a better way. My feelings weren't validated in the foster home that I was brought up in. I didn't get a lot of maternal guidance and direction and teachings about how a lady conducts herself, and I tried many of the wrong ways to deal with my problems.
Tell me a little bit more about your childhood, Jerry. You mentioned that you were in a foster home. Take me through your childhood a little bit.
I just remember as a young child being in a state institution with bars on the wall, laying on a cot in a room, total silence, and looking at the bars, curled up in a fetal position, not covered up with a blanket, but on top of a scratchy wool blanket. Then after that, I went into a foster home. At first, the woman of the house treated me kindly. But then one day, as I was turning into a young lady around the age of 12, 13, she told me she hated me. But I didn't take it seriously. I thought perhaps, you know, she's just saying this. But I think her intention was to inflict emotional harm on me, which she did by her behavior and the way she treated me compared to how she treated her other two daughters.
And did you stay in that home until you were an adult?
I did. And to the age of 18, I left as quickly as I could at the age of 18.
How do you think your childhood played into your mental health?
My childhood made a direct impact on my mental illness because my diagnosis of borderline personality disorder is directly affected by the way I wasn't nurtured and my feelings weren't taken seriously, my thoughts and ideas didn't matter.
And when were you finally given this diagnosis of borderline personality disorder?
It wasn't until many years later that I was given the diagnosis after taking some sort of tests in a psychiatric hospital. I don't know the name of the tests, but they showed me images, pictures or dots or some sort of whatever, and asked what I thought of these things. And I tried not to pass the test because to me everything wasn't what I wanted to see in the picture, but I saw what I saw, and they were smart enough to know, you know, that I was borderline. I have all the hallmarks of borderline personality disorder. Some people have some, but I have them all, I think, because it started so early in my life in the institution, the pain and the mood disorder.
How did that feel, Jerry, to finally have a label or some words to describe how you were feeling when you got this diagnosis?
It was a relief in a way to know the diagnosis. But then it was also a painful thing too, because that diagnosis is so cringed upon by some of the case managers, some of the people who are there to help you, the counselors at the Community Mental Health. But I see now that it's okay. It's okay.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Joe Lindstroth, and I'm speaking with Lansing resident Jerry Nicole Wright about what it's like to live with a severe and persistent mental illness. What was the turning point for you, Jerry?
The turning point had to be when a community mental health case manager back in 1994 called me. I was homebound at the time and asked if I would be interested in joining a new DBT skills group.
And DBT is short for dialectical behavioral therapy.
Right.
Which, just to give our listeners a sense, is one of the methods that is used to treat borderline personality disorder, which, without going too much into it, is one of the more difficult mental illnesses to treat. There are very few medications that work, mostly with symptoms, but not to address borderline
right.
personality disorder.
Right.
So explain how the DBT worked for you.
The DBT worked because first it got me out of the house. Like I said, I was homebound. And then I started learning different ways to think, learning about how my mind worked and how I could make it work better for me. I learned the first module, Core Mindfulness, about reasonable mind, emotion mind, and you take a little bit of both, and you have what's called the wise mind. And that's where we want our minds to be, especially with my diagnosis. It also taught me that the very last skill, radical acceptance, that, you know, I may not like something, but reality is, and I must accept instead of acting out or harming myself, radically accept the situation, you know.
Can you give our listeners an example of how that works in your brain, of how it taught you to change the way you view a situation or to change how you feel about something?
I would sometime cut myself, but after learning DBT skills, I stopped cutting myself. The particular skill is like tolerating the moment. The moment I felt severe pain, I had to tolerate that pain. And I knew that that pain would not last forever. So I could tolerate that pain in the next moment too. And I knew that the pain, if it still lasted, that I could tolerate it again for another moment. That skill is one mindfully in the moment, one of the skills that I used to help me manage the physical and the psychological pain that I was feeling that was so overwhelming, so severe. But I would just hold myself and say, I can get through this in this moment.
It sounds like, Jerry, that it's been a lot of hard work to get to where you are today. Did you ever think about giving up?
Yes, I did.
What kept you going?
The love that I had in my life. I had some love from my husband. I had some love from some dear friends. I know my family relations were strained. They still are, but I did have some love. When I made my first suicide attempt at age of 15, that was why I tried to take my life, because I had no love. And the mother rejected me, and the foster father was always away working. I told myself and my peers in high school that I couldn't live without love, so I made that was the reason.
And now you found love?
I have love. I have love for myself now. I respect myself, and I know I'm a good person. I try very hard on my job. I try to support my clubhouse, charter house. I try to take care and support my husband. We've been married 20 years this September, Tom and I. We've been married 20 years this September.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Joe Lindstroth, and I'm speaking with Lansing resident Jerry Nicole Wright about what it's like to live with a severe and persistent mental illness. Jerry, there are a lot of stigmas surrounding mental illness and people who have mental illnesses. They're not intelligent. They're not capable of taking care of themselves. They're weird. They're violent. That seems to be coming up a lot lately. Have you ever been stigmatized? And in what ways?
Because I have a mental illness, and because the society or the culture we live in shows that people with mental illness are violent and dangerous and, like you said, not smart maybe, or might not be clean maybe, or people who don't have the mental illness might think that, they need to keep a distance from them. I've seen that sort of behavior, people putting like a distance from me because they know I have a mental illness. But like I said, there's a person on the other side of that mental illness wanting to find their way back. They want to, be redeemed. They want to come back and have a life.
When you sense that people put that distance between you and them, how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel uncomfortable. Makes me feel, I don't, now with the DBT skills, take away any value from myself. But I'm hoping that maybe that person and maybe our culture, maybe our society will someday say, well, you're okay. You have a mental illness. You take your medicine. You go to work. You have your marriage. You have your home. You take care of your property. Your husband cuts the grass while maybe you're doing the laundry in the basement. That maybe someday things will be different. That the social stigma might be removed somehow. And I think maybe that's going to take a lot of work. A lot of work.
Why are you here talking to me, Jerry, about your struggles with mental illness? This is very private. You certainly don't have to make your life public. Why are you here?
I'm here to be a voice for those who have yet to find the voice, those who are mentally ill. I would like to maybe reduce some of the stigma that mentally ill people are faced with on a daily basis, to let them know that there are nonviolent people who have an illness. That's like another illness, a physical illness, but it's in the brain. And that I want them to be heard. I want them to be thought of, not just in a negative way, but in a way where they can, you know, come and take responsibility for their lives and be included in life and not ostracized and cast to the side and, you know, let's forget about them, you know.
Jerry Nicole Wright is a longtime Lansing resident who suffers from borderline personality disorder, which is a severe mental illness. Thank you, Jerry, for sharing your remarkable story with me.
Thank you, Joe, for letting me share my story.
For Current State, I'm Joe Lindstroth.
We have news today from the Mackinac Island Policy Conference. Current State has learned Governor Rick Snyder has called on the legislature to consider including Michigan's LGBT citizens in the state's Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act.
I don't believe in discrimination. I think it would be great if they actually, the legislature looked at the issue later in the year.
Again, Governor Rick Snyder calling on the state legislature to consider including LGBT citizens under protections afforded by Michigan's Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. That news from Mackinac Island. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. We often talk about the health of the Great Lakes on Current State, and one very direct indicator of how the lakes are doing is, how's the fishing? About a decade ago, the answer in Lake Huron was not so good because of a steep decline in fish numbers during that time. WKAR's Melissa Benmark joins us now with a look at the lake.
Hi, Mark. I talked with David Fielder. He's a fisheries research biologist for the DNR and a doctoral student at MSU, and he perhaps gets the award for coolest office location. He cannot see Thunder Bay from his office, but he told me during our interview that if he looked around the corner of the door, he could actually look out on the river emptying up into Thunder Bay.
Nice.
So it's pretty gorgeous up there. I caught up with him up there in his office and asked him what happened to Lake Huron 10 years ago and why it happened.
The profound shift in the fish community that happened in that time period that you're speaking of, 2003-2004, really traced to some ecological changes that we believe began with the invasion of zebra mussels and then after them quagga mussels. And what they did is to really restructure some of the lower food web that limited the availability of a lot of traditional invertebrate prey to our prey fish community. Simultaneous to that, we had a higher predator abundance than what we realized at the time, and so we had a lot of predator fish consuming the prey fish. So the prey fish community was being squeezed on both ends, if you will, kind of a bottom-up and a top-down effect. And to this day, there's a lot of debate as to which one of those influences most accounted for the change in the prey fish community. When I'm speaking of the prey fish community, I'm mostly talking about alewives, but rainbow smelt and other species contracted and diminished in number in response to all these changes. It really kind of came to a head there in the early 2000s. So pretty much overnight, alewives disappeared from most of Lake Huron, which is something few of us thought we'd ever see. Alewives are not native. They're an invasive species that came here from the Atlantic Ocean.
But they were introduced, weren't they?
Well, they weren't purposely introduced. They came in through the canal system that bypassed Niagara Falls, the Welland Canal, and they came in to Lake Huron about the early 1900s. They really became abundant about 1940s and 50s. And what happened was a lot of our native prey fish disappeared in response to the colonization by alewives. So our predator community became dependent on alewives as their main food resource. The Chinook salmon fed on them almost exclusively, but so did lake trout, walleye, a lot of our other predator species, all depended on alewives. So when alewives disappeared, the very first thing that we saw was Chinook salmon that we had out there became very thin, very gaunt, and their growth declined, and their survival diminished, and they basically just disappeared. Chinook they aren't flexible enough to go down and feed on the bottom for things like round gobies, or maybe up on the surface for terrestrial insects. our native predators are able to adapt better.
And, a little more enterprising.
And they are. And lake trout can do that, for example, and have been doing very well now in spite of the disappearance of alewives. And so have walleyes, for that matter. So maybe the most obvious impact for anglers has been the loss of most of the Chinook salmon fishery that we were accustomed to. But for our native fish species like walleye and lake trout, it's really been kind of a boon in that they are both reproducing much better in the absence of alewives.
Hmm, that's interesting. So that it's like you get an invasive in there and everything wants to eat that, but then they die, but then the things that are more flexible and eat other things do better.
That's... In a nutshell, that's what's going on. Now, there are some non-natives that are also able to adapt better to this situation. That includes steelhead. A lot of people forget the steelhead or rainbow trout. Not native to our lakes, but they've been here for so long, they're kind of a naturalized species.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing pretty well. They are one of the species that can go up and feed on the surface for, say, terrestrial insects that are wind-blown out to the lake, for example. Atlantic salmon are also showing a lot of promise in their ability to adapt to this new food web. So we have stepped up some of our Atlantic salmon stocking in an effort to see if we can maximize their role in the, you know, for fishing opportunity for the angling public.
That's one thing I wondered about, was that with, you know, the economy and various government cutbacks, how that had affected fish stocking, because I can imagine that, you know, there might not be as much money for it as there once was.
Well, everything we do in the DNR and the fisheries division, of course, traces back to funding at some point or another. Our fish hatchery system, though, is well-developed and an important part of our fisheries division activities, such that their role is really more a function of our stocking needs. It's programmed out by management and research. It doesn't ebb and flow as much with available funding. So we've done our best to make sure that those facilities are staffed and functioning to meet the fish stocking needs of the state.
Most of our listeners are familiar with, you know, sort of the usual suspects in terms of Great Lakes invasive species, lampreys, zebra mussels, quagga mussels, that kind of thing, and, of course, the Asian carp. But are there any new ones that you're seeing that are emerging, that, especially that might be unique to Lake Huron, that you're concerned about?
Well, it's not unique to Lake Huron, but the round goby has been here for a relatively short amount of time. It was in the 1990s that they first started to become abundant, and we're still trying to understand their role in this whole fish community and the food web. Some of our more recent research has illustrated that they have become a very, very important prey fish or dietary item for a lot of our fish species and predators in Lake Huron, and probably the same to some degree in the other Great Lakes, that in the absence of alewives, that's one of the most abundant prey fishes out there. So when we think about Lake Huron and what went on in the early 2000s, it's easy to cast that as a decline in fish and a collapse of fish. Really is more of a shift than it was a collapse or a decline, because the amount of biomass out there in round gobies is probably very substantial and might rival what the biomass was for some of our pelagic prey fish before that shift. And so everything's kind of down on the bottom now. Gobies are a bottom-oriented fish, and that's really directing a lot of the production down to the benthic zone of the lake and the nearshore area. And that's why those predators that can go down there and take advantage of that and adapt to it are doing okay, and the others that just can't make that adaptation are really in trouble.
So basically the fish are having to dig deeper for food.
Right, and some species are better at that than others.
So do you have a general sense of the state of both commercial and sport fishing on Lake Huron these days?
Sport fishing, overall, the amount of effort that has been exerted by the sport fishery in the Michigan waters has declined with the contraction and diminishment of the Chinook salmon population, as you would expect, for the reasons I described. Chinook salmon were really the most popular sport fishery that we had. And when those numbers declined, you know, fishermen just quit fishing for them, or they would go over to Lake Michigan where Chinook were still abundant. But we have had some real increases and resurgence in certain walleye now in this in recent years have fully recovered in Saginaw Bay. It's been an enormous success story, something that we didn't think we'd see for many decades to come, let alone in such a short time span. And that's credited to the absence of alewives. Alewives are a predator on newly hatched walleye fry. So in the absence of alewives, walleye were reproducing much better and reached our recovery targets in 2006. So
wow.
We are enjoying some of the best walleye fishing we've ever had on Lake Huron, and arguably some of the best in the Great Lakes right now. So if there's those kinds of opportunities. Lake trout, similarly, are doing much better in the absence of alewives, reproducing better. We're seeing gains there in numbers. So there's some excellent lake trout fishing taking place. Those species have not fully been able to replace the loss of the Chinook fishery, but it would be very wrong to say that there isn't good fishing opportunity on Lake Huron. If you like those species, there's just tremendous opportunity right now. That means both nearshore fishing opportunity and offshore for things like lake trout. And there's still some Chinook out there, too. We see them in the catch all the time. They just aren't the numbers that were there at one time. Then you throw in some Atlantic salmon or some steelhead, and you can have a very diverse and satisfying fishing trip out of a lot of our ports up and down the coast. So that's our sport fishery situation. The commercial fishery in Lake Huron targets a variety of species, but really lake whitefish is the centerpiece of that. And the numbers have trended differently depending on what part of the lake that you're looking at. We've had some concerns about lake whitefish reproduction in recent years. We haven't seen as many young fish coming up. We're not sure of what the long-term status of lake whitefish are going to be, but for the most part, the fisheries are holding up, especially down around the outer Saginaw Bay ports there are doing pretty well. And then there, of course, is the tribal fishery for lake whitefish in northern Lake Huron, and by all accounts, that's doing pretty well also.
I think one thing that maybe the average fish eater doesn't realize is the average age of a whitefish on your plate. It's older than people think, isn't it?
Yeah, they're one of the longer-lived species. It's not unusual to have even a 20-year-old lake whitefish. And their growth will slow down such that they can, as they age, they're not going to always get bigger and bigger, but they're all very long-lived species, as is lake trout.
Well, David Fielder, thanks so much for joining us and catching us up on the state of Lake Huron.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope people get out and try some fishing for themselves.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
African-American author, poet Maya Angelou died Wednesday at her home in North Carolina. The literary star was best known for her volumes of poetry and her biography, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, but she was also a civil rights activist, singer, and dancer. In 2010, she received the country's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Maya Angelou visited Michigan State University several times in her life. 24 years ago this month, she spoke in the school's celebrity lecture series. Here is an excerpt from that address.
As a practicing Christian, I say God has given me this machine and this heart and one life. That's all. That's all. Yes, one life, one heart, and one head. That's it. And nobody has more, and nobody here has less.
Maya Angelou was 86. That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we visit with Lansing School District Superintendent Yvonne Kamal Kanul, and it's a live music Friday. We'll be joined by singer-guitarist Jerry Sprigg and his band. Have a great day. You've been listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR.